Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, July 19, 2019. 8 people are killed during inter-clan fighting in Western Lake State.
The result of the casualties, approximately there are 8 and then 3 injured. This is the information that I got, but I'm not sure actually whether these are the correct information or not.
And a standoff continues amongst students at Dr. John Garang Memorial University in Bor.
They look at my eyes strangely and ask me a stereotype question by asking, where are you from? I try to keep quiet, but the second time asked me seriously. Then I said, I'm from Awil, Barakaza. As I said that, they start beating me. Other who didn't have a stick also woke me until I fell down.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Eight people were killed and several others injured today during inter-clan clashes in South Sudan's Western Lake State. The state's information minister, Majak Isaac Rohr, says the governor and security forces visited villages affected by the clashes. Rohr says South Sudan should try to carry out a comprehensive disarmament to remove guns from the hands of civilians. He blames revenge killings for Friday's clashes.
Early in the morning, a group from gun section and from police section, those of police, they killed one from gun section and then went immediately revenge and made an attack. And then they killed two from the other side. And then the fighting went on so until later in the noontime, the fighting has finished. But the result of the casualties, approximately there are 8 and then 3 injured. This is the information that I got, but I'm not sure actually whether these are the correct information or not.
What was the cause of this fighting? This is not the first time these two communities are fighting each other. What triggered the fighting?
You know, you had sometimes back when you interviewed me about the fighting between these two sections. It is the revenge killing, by the way, because when someone is killed from the other group, the other group will try to look for a person of that equality to be also killed in terms of compensation, for instance. That is the revenge killing only. There is nothing beyond that.
What are the authorities doing to stop what you are calling revenge killing? Because people are losing lives at a time that when there is peace in the country. What are the authorities doing, whether at a state level or national level, to prevent this kind of killings from repeating itself?
Well, the solution actually will be the inclusive disarmament of the citizens. But that exercise is not completed due to some logistical issues. The state authority is trying its best to stop the fighting. This morning, when the fighting erupted out, the governor and the security forces were organized, and then they went there together so that the fighting is held. So people are working hard to make sure that the security is maintained in the area. But you know, the area is very vast. It is not a simple issue to get control of the people who are fighting.
Some communities are suspicious that when disarmament is carried out, they are being targeted and left other communities armed. This seems to be like a national crisis. Do you agree with me on that?
Yeah, you know, this issue of disarmament, it is not done partially, by the way. We say that the inclusive disarmament has to be carried out. But after disarming some groups, they went and looked for where there's armed, because the flow of arms is something continuously is taking place. You disarm them today, after 3 days, 4 days, they get another arm, and then the fighting continues. So this one, it needs inclusive disarmament and intensive plan so that this thing is carried out at a national level and a state level.
Where do they get their arms? You're saying there's a flow of arms. What I know that in South Sudan, the guns are only with the soldiers.
Rebellion and opposition have so many. So many people are actually getting arms through the other rebel groups who are nearby the state.
And how would you react to people who would say the government's failure is blamed on the rebels? I mean, a government is a government. The government is supposed to be in control of the security situation of the country.
No. The government is not failing, by the way. You see, as I talked to you last time, that the nature of South Sudan and the environment is really encouraging the issue of indiscipline, and is encouraging also the rebellion. At the government, at the national level, and at the state level, we will be able to put this into an end when the time comes. So what are we doing now? We have to see that the revitalized agreement is fully implemented, and then the rebel group of the government, when they become the one government, which is Al-Kigano, they will be able to make inclusive disarmament.
That's Isaac Majakror, Western Lakes Minister of Information. He was speaking to me from Rumbek earlier today. Students at Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology in Bor Town, who hail from Bahr al-Ghazal region, say they don't feel safe on campus after a misunderstanding with members of the host community. A student who hails from Bahr al-Ghazal says he was beaten up by young men from the host community. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
26-year-old Stephen Malwale Pioth is a fourth-year student doing public administration at Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology in Bor. Malwale says he was beaten by the brothers of a young woman he tried to court earlier 2 weeks ago. Following that incident, groups of students hailing from the Bahr al-Ghazal region retaliated by attacking youth from a neighboring university campus. Malwale says it all began 2 weeks ago, about 6 p.m. while chatting with relatives at the entrance of the university, and spoke to a woman on the road.
She stopped and told me her name and said she didn't have time and she never need any relationship. She left, and immediately after she left, there came six gentlemen. Two of them are from cattle camp, according to the address, and they were carrying big sticks. As they came, they asked me a question, that what is your connection with the lady? That the past question they asked. I told them, there is no any connection, because it is first time to see her, and I would like to know her. That's why I approached her. They look at my eyes strangely and ask me a stereotype question by asking, where are you from? From there, I tried to keep quiet to answer such a question, but the second time asked me seriously. Then I said, I'm from Awil, Bahr al-Ghazal. As I said that, they start beating me. Other who didn't have a stick also broke me until I fell down.
Malwale says his head, arm and hands were injured in the beating. He says he and other students from Bahr al-Ghazal now fear moving outside the campus because they might be attacked.
After they went there, one of the students was suspected by the youth in that area that is from Bahr al-Ghazal. While that man is not from Bahr al-Ghazal, he's from Bor. But he normally stay in Bahr al-Ghazal so much. So after they suspect him, they were trying to harm him while walking with that brother. So that brother who was walking with him was the one who rescued him, who said that this guy is from Bor. So he also explained himself through the language. So after that, they understand that the guy is from Bor. So after these two students came back to the university, they are our friends. So they tell us that in this area is risky.
Malwale says the situation is still tense because state officials are not expediting the case.
It should suppose for governor to intervene on this thing that day, because there is a message that I have heard from the hospital by the doctor that the governor himself upset.
Malwale says false rumors are being spread while nothing is done. John Garang Memorial University student Ugude Andrew, a student representative, says now some students are not venturing outside the campus because they don't feel it is safe.
I just wanted the state government to speed up the system because we are, I mean to say, to speed up the kids because we are approaching our exams. So that is not going to traumatize us. Because among those 10 students whom their name has been mentioned, okay, there is a majority of them have never been what they have been accused of, okay? So therefore, we would like the state government to speed up the process, such that the case to hand, like in the line of this week and then next, with the collaboration of the administration, such that we are to approach our exams freely.
Akenya Jinruk is the chairperson of the Board Community Youth Association.
The student was warned at first that you should not follow this lady anymore, because you came here for education, not for the courtship. So later on, when he was warned, didn't understand, he came back. So the brothers of the lady decided to attack him, and actually they tried to slap him or give him some punch. So that thing happened. And it's something normal, actually. That used to happen here in Bor.
Akay says the students should feel safe because youth leaders have convinced the local youth to stop attacking students. Jonglei State Governor Makiri Thiong'o-Mal declined to comment on the matter, saying the case is being handled by the police. Dr. Coach Ruben, the academic registrar at the university, also declined to comment on the incident. Police arrested 8 students from Baralgazalt but released them on bail. Jonglei State Police Commissioner Yusuf Abdallah Garang says police have investigated the case and the perpetrators will soon be tried in a court of law. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Still on student affairs, some students at the University of Juba are complaining about space at student hostels on campus. The students say many hostel rooms are still occupied by individuals who graduated many years ago and are still living on campus. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
University of Juba student Ayen Makur says she was unable to secure a space at the university hostel because she was told all beds were occupied. She says there would be enough beds for students if people living in the hostel who graduated years ago would be ordered to leave.
There are those who are there who are not even students. They just occupy the space. They just stay there. When you come, you want to stay there, there's no pretty chance that you can get to have a bed. So we decided you just started from home to school, and this thing have hurt it us. It spent a lot of money to us to travel from Delhi to university. Sometimes I come when the lectures have already finished.
Makur says many non-students residing at the hostel run businesses like selling airtime or charcoal, or they cook food to sell within the hostel. She says some go to their workplaces and just return to the hostel in the evening to sleep. Taban Malau, another student at the University of Juba, says he used to live in the university hostel but decided to leave because of the building's poor hygiene. He says the beds were full of bed bugs and the university administrators never bothered to look into the condition of the hostels.
The beds which had been supposed to be used by the student, they are very pure. Some of the beds also, they have been broken since long time and they are not repaired. Another problem is university hostel is also occupied by a student of the University of Juba.
Malau says non-students likely sneaked into the hostels because they have free services like indoor plumbing. He says the way most people secure living arrangements in the hostel is by knowing someone already living there who agrees to reserve a bed for you.
Let us, these hostel people stay in colleges, not in these communities. People group themselves in communities, in the hostel. We need them to be College of Law, purely student of College of Law. Economics the same, School of Management the same, Drama the same, so that you can avoid this conflict.
University student Riak Makar says the Juba University Students Union have complained about the presence of non-students occupying the hostel since 2012, but the university administration has never done anything about it. He says some students even share beds. Makar says university administrators should allocate the hostel rooms according to college students' majors so that they can easily identify who is not a student.
The leadership of students is actually working on that, trying to identify who are actually staying in the hostels. So we are aware, and might be in the next 1 week we'll get a report from the leadership of students to confirm whether this is correct or not.
Robert Deng, Deputy Vice Chancellor of the University of Juba, says university authorities are working on the problem. Deng says once non-students are identified, university administrators will order them to leave the hostels. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudan's Communist Party rejects the latest power-sharing deal. Find out more when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there something about yourself that you would like to change?
Definitely not. No, because at least I know my life has been good. I've not been entertaining bad company. So to maybe to change my life, I need to start making at least new friends again.
Life is all about learning. We learn every day. So in as much as we are still breathing, there are things we need to shed off.
Currently, I would like to change my tummy. I'm growing a pot belly. So I'm exercising. I've bought an abdomen machine that's helping me to deal with it. And I want to lose weight, probably 5-8 kilos.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Sudanese Communist Party has rejected the recent power-sharing agreement reached between military and opposition leaders. Sadiq Yusuf, who represented the Communist Party in the talks that led to the signing of the power-sharing agreement, says the Sovereign Council should be dominated by civilians. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudan Communist Party member Sadiq Yusuf says before the deadly June 3rd crackdown on protesters, the two sides had agreed to have more civilian members in the Sovereign Council so that civilians would have an upper hand in a transitional civilian government. Yusuf insists the Transitional Military Council betrayed opposition by changing its position on what had been agreed to earlier. He says the recent signed deal does not give the Prime Minister full control over his or her cabinet.
The new statement states that the military members of the Sovereign Council would appoint two ministers, the Minister of Interior and Minister of Defense. And that was not agreed before. The agreement before was that the Force and Change, Freedom and Change movement will appoint all the ministers.
Yusuf says the deal gives more power to the military than the civilians. Despite those objections, he says the Communist Party will remain part of the Forces for Freedom and Change coalition in order to take part in the next round of the negotiations on details that were not worked out in the power-sharing deal.
We are still part of the Freedom and Change organization. And we are going to discuss the second paper, what is called the constitutional document. But the meeting has been deferred from today. No further date has been appointed.
Members of the Sudanese Revolutionary Front, an armed group led by Tom Haju, issued a statement on Wednesday rejecting the agreement as well, saying it does not cover all the aspirations of the Sudanese people. Yesterday, the Forces for Freedom and Change coalition organized a mass protest in Khartoum to honor the more than 100 peaceful protesters who were killed by Sudanese security forces outside army headquarters. Thousands of pro-democracy protesters gathered at what was called Green Yard, but has been renamed Freedom Yard in honor of the slain protesters. The people were calling for justice for the victims, chanting slogans like, "Your souls are alive among us, we will not forget you." Sadiq Farouk, a member of the committee that organized yesterday's event and a member of the Forces for Freedom and Change coalition, told South Sudan in Focus that the rally was also meant to mark the renaming of certain streets in Khartoum after some of the martyrs of Sudan's revolution.
It's a decision by many activists, and calls has been there placed on the social media and by the what we call the resistance committee in the neighborhood. So they decided to rename the streets after martyrs who sacrificed their life.
Farouk says the famous street number 40 in Omdurman neighborhood was renamed after Abdulaziz Abubakar, a Sudanese man who was killed by security forces in January. The protest began in December after prices for bread and fuel skyrocketed. He says the coalition has asked African Union mediators for more time before negotiating on the constitutional document.
We need more time to reach more consensus among ourselves as forces for freedom and change regarding the documents and the draft that we have received from their end, and also to do some consultation with the Sudanese armed group.
The Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition signed a power-sharing deal Wednesday, which sets up 5 military and 5 civilian members of the Sovereign Council, along by an 11 member picked by both sides and a Council of Ministers. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The United Nations says Zimbabwe's food situation is moving from crisis to an emergency. It says a majority of the population is food insecure because of El Nino-induced drought and the ongoing economic crisis. Columbus Mavunga has more for VOA from Harare.
The impoverished town of Epworth, less than an hour drive southeast of Harare, is one of the places in Zimbabwe in desperate need of food aid. 48-year-old Placidus Shibura says she's struggling to look after her grandchildren because of the harsh economic conditions in Zimbabwe. She says, "We have resorted to just one meal a day, and at times it's just the vegetables we get in our garden. We are struggling to get money to buy food. I wish donors would bring us food, especially for the children, as I'm not employed. Even school fees I can't pay. One of the children was not well, so medical bills are coming." According to a recent report by UN aid agencies and the government, Zimbabwe needs about $218 million to stave off hunger about 5.5 million people between now and April 2020, when the next harvest is expected. Thus assuming there will be enough rains. Bishop Parajuli, the coordinator of UN agencies in Zimbabwe, is urging farmers to invest in irrigation and small grains as part of efforts to reduce the effects of climate. The World Body says Zimbabwe is among several Southern African nations hit by extreme weather in the 2018-2019 growing season. The drought has devastated crops, especially corn, which is used to make the staple food sadza, a thick porridge that is served with relish. In addition, Cyclone Idai in March destroyed many crops a few weeks before harvest time.
Unfortunately, we're moving from crisis to emergency, which is pretty serious. Also, the economic challenges facing the country. People have lost their income, and the situation is really precarious.
The drought has also affected the water supply. Michael Chideme, the spokesman for Harare, says two of the capital's reservoirs have dried out and others are following suit. Water rationing has begun. Parajuli says Zimbabwe is hoping and depending on the generosity of international community. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And now for some sports news. Football fans around Africa are glued to their television sets to watch Algeria and Senegal playing tonight in the African Cup of Nations final. An exhibition in Paris takes a long view of football, exploring its multifaceted link to people and politics in the Arab world and former colonial powerhouse France. Leisha Bryant visited the show at the Arab World Institute in the French capital, and has this report.
In a darkened room, children watch the replay of the 1998 World Cup final that took place years before they were born. There's the intent face of Zinedine Zidane, the star French player of Berber origin. He counted among France's winning multicultural team that rallied the nation under the slogan Black, Blanc, Beurre, or Black, White, and Arab. It's one of the many snapshots of soccer's powerful role in shaping history and society in the Arab world, featured in this exhibit titled Soccer and the Arab World, The Revolution of the Round Ball.
Football in the Arab world is always linked to the history of the country and also very linked to politics.
Show curator Aurélie Clément-Ruiz.
Because in the stadium and, you know, the fans and even the team are really the reflect of what's happening in the whole society.
The show examines soccer's role as a vehicle for political expression, women's emancipation, and soft power. Besides the Nations Cup, it was time to coincide with another major soccer event, the Women's World Cup in France, which sparked a global debate about gender equality in sports. This exhibit looks at another game changer, focusing on Jordan's 16-year-old female soccer team.
It's really interesting to see all these women really want to play football, you know, even against their fathers, sometimes their families. They just want to play football, and most of the time they can play football. It really shows something a little bit different from the idea that we all have of women in the Arab world.
The exhibit also traces the origins of Algeria's first team during their country's war of independence. It examines soccer's role in the Arab Spring uprisings and Qatar's winning but controversial bid to host the Middle East's first World Cup in 2022, and the evolution of France's own multicultural team to symbolize the country today. Teenager Ali Mokoso said she loved the show, especially the parts dealing with youth and female soccer players. French Algerian fan Saber Gekout liked learning how the game evolved from his parents' time. Not surprisingly, he's rooting for an Algerian victory on Friday. He's not the only one.
Of course, we will be very glad if Algeria could win. Yeah, it will be great.
The Arab World Institute planned to broadcast the Nations Cup final on a giant outdoor screen. There's also a miniature football field for the amateurs. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
Well, we want to thank our listeners in Western Lake States for updating us on what is happening in their area. That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Kalina Shtakal by Lomerika Sun. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Have a peaceful weekend, and please join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. ما في داعي لمشاكل تفرز تبلي كل يوم ما في داعي لكتل صوت لا جري جري كل يوم سانا بودا بودا تالي ساشوكو سانا اتالي زاتو تالي ساشوكو كوكو كوكو واتي شجرة ورا شجرة على بكوشنا دومونا Wa mungu la wa wana sasi ya satar farid mabu wa dina gita Kelina shtaka, asha sana belede Kelina shtaka, asha sana belede Kelina si
Bushoko Castellani, Yakona. Kelina Sibu Dubu Kasumaku at Sakit Yakwana. The hate street.